There is a kind of dream that does not begin at the beginning. It begins with noticing. Noticing the softness beneath your shoulder. Noticing a faint hum, so steady that it seems less like a sound than a condition of being alive. Noticing a coolness in the air, and then a warmer current moving slowly over your hands, as though some unseen system is breathing the room awake. When I opened my eyes, I was lying on a narrow bed in a room that did not quite look like a bedroom. It had the quiet simplicity of a cabin on a ship, but not the cramped severity one might expect from a vessel crossing oceans or stars. The walls were pale gray, curved at the edges, with no visible seams. A small round window hovered above the desk, although window may be the wrong word, because nothing outside it appeared fixed. A soft blur of blue-white mist moved beyond the glass, occasionally thinning enough to reveal a field of stars, then thickening again, until the universe looked like breath on a mirror. For a while I did not get up. There is often a temptation in strange places to begin with alarm, to sit upright too quickly, to ask where one is, to search for danger. But this room did not encourage alarm. It encouraged listening. The hum in the walls had a patient tone. The bed was not luxurious exactly, but it had remembered the shape of me. On the desk was a small cup of water, covered by a transparent lid, and beside it a smooth black square about the size of a book. When I finally sat up, the floor warmed faintly beneath my feet. The black square lit as I touched it, not with words at first, but with a simple pattern, three circles arranged in a triangle, each one filled with a different shade of blue. Then the circles drifted apart, leaving faint trails behind them, and came to rest along the edges of the square. I waited. A line appeared. Welcome back. I did not know whether this was comforting or strange, perhaps both. Welcome would have been strange enough. Back was stranger. Another line appeared underneath. The first door is ready when you are. There are some statements that make no demand and therefore become difficult to resist. I drank the water, which tasted faintly of minerals and something like cucumber, though that may only have been my mind assigning it a familiar kindness. I found folded clothing in a recessed drawer, soft trousers, a tunic, socks with a grippy weave. Nothing seemed new exactly. Everything seemed as though it had been waiting. The door opened when I approached it. Beyond was a corridor, with low light running along the floor. The walls were the same pale gray as the room, but here they carried thin inlaid lines, like silver threads embedded just beneath the surface. They flowed forward in gentle curves, sometimes crossing, sometimes diverging, forming maps that did not belong to any country I knew. Now and then, the corridor passed more doors. Some were closed and unmarked. Some had small symbols above them, a spiral, a leaf, a square within a square, seven dots. I did not try them yet. The first door I assumed would make itself known. It did. At the end of the corridor was a wide circular hatch, and on it were the same three blue circles I had seen on the black square beside the bed. They were not painted on the door. They floated a finger's width away from it, like small moons. As I came near, the circles moved apart, and then returned to their triangular arrangement. A voice spoke, softly, from everywhere and nowhere. Arrange the memory of motion. It was not a command. It sounded more like a suggestion from someone who had set out a board game on a rainy afternoon. I touched one of the circles. It glided under my finger, leaving a luminous arc. When I released it, it drifted back to the edge of the hatch. I moved another, and it too left an arc, shorter this time. After a few minutes of playing, because that is what it was at first, I realized that each circle remembered the path I gave it. When I touched all three in order, they repeated their movements, tracing a small choreography in blue light. Arrange the memory of motion. The phrase became less cryptic as I let it sit. The three circles had begun in a triangle. Perhaps they wanted to move and return, not simply to end somewhere, but to make a motion that held together. I drew the first circle in a wide curve to the left, a second in a smaller curve to the right, and the third straight down and up again. They repeated the paths. The door remained closed. I tried spirals. I tried making them cross. I tried matching their movements to the rhythm of the hum in the walls. Once, by accident, all three arrived at the center of the hatch at the same moment, and the door gave a low tone. Not opening yet, but acknowledging something. That is one of the pleasures of a puzzle. When it is made gently, it does not scold you for not knowing. It simply tells you, quietly, when you have brushed against the shape of the answer. So I tried again, making the three circles start from different places and arrive at the center together. The trick was not the destination. It was timing. The long path had to begin first, the short path last. I found myself leaning closer, listening not only with my ears, but with that small interior sense that measures rhythm before thought. At last, all three circles moved inward, curved, paused, and touched the center together. The door opened. Beyond it was not another corridor, but a room filled with mist. Not thick mist, not the kind that hides things entirely. More like early morning fog over a quiet lake, a luminous pale gray that softened the edges of everything. The room seemed larger than it should have been. A platform extended from the door, then divided into several narrow bridges, each leading into a different part of the fog. Suspended above the platform were glass spheres of different sizes, each containing a small object. A brass key, a feather, a folded paper boat, a seed, a stone with a hole through it. I stepped forward, and the door closed behind me with a sound like a sigh. A figure stood on one of the bridges, perhaps 20 paces away. At first I thought it was a statue, because it did not move. Then it turned. It was a woman, or someone who had chosen the general shape of a woman, dressed in the same soft gray clothing I was wearing. Her hair was silver-white, cut short, and her face had the calm attentiveness of a person reading in a library. "Oh," she said, "you're awake." The simple normality of this sentence made the whole situation feel less strange. "I think so," I said. She smiled. "That's usually enough to begin with." Her name, she told me, was Mara, or at least that was the name she had found written on the inside of her sleeve when she woke. I checked mine and found a small stitched line of text near the wrist. I did not know whether it was my name, but it seemed willing to serve. Mara had been in the mist room for some time, although time on the ship, she said, was difficult to hold. There were no clocks, or else there were clocks everywhere, and none of them agreed. The room's puzzle involved the suspended spheres, the bridges, and the objects inside them. The goal, if that was the right word, was to open the next hatch on the far side of the room. She pointed, and I saw, dimly through the mist, a round door with no visible handle. "I can see part of it," she said, "but I can't reach it. The bridge I need isn't there unless two objects are removed from their spheres at once." "How do you know?" "I've tried doing one at a time. The bridge appears and then vanishes before I can cross. It feels like a conversation that needs two voices." We stood together and looked at the room. There was something pleasant about having another person present, not because she explained everything, but because the mist no longer belonged entirely to me. We were both looking into it. We could be mistaken together. The spheres opened when touched, but only if their object was named aloud. This, too, we discovered by trial and error. Mara touched the sphere with the feather and said, "Feather." It opened. I touched the one with the brass key and said, "Key." Nothing happened. Mara tried brass key, and it opened. The ship apparently appreciated specificity, but not pedantry. Small yellowish metal object did nothing at all. When the feather and brass key were removed together, a bridge appeared briefly in the mist, faint at first, then solidifying. It stretched toward the door, but not far enough. We placed the objects back in their spheres, and the bridge withdrew like a thought forgotten. There were perhaps 20 spheres. We could not know which combination would form the full path, so we began testing. Feather and seed, paper boat and stone, brass key and stone, seed and paper boat. Some pairs made no bridge. Some made short bridges. One pair caused a gentle chime and made the mist glow amber for several seconds, which seemed meaningful, though not immediately useful. As we worked, we talked in the unfocused way people do when their hands are occupied. Mara said she remembered a garden, but not whether it was hers. She remembered kneeling in damp soil and pressing seeds into rows with one finger. She remembered the smell of tomato leaves. She did not remember arriving on the ship. I told her I remembered rain on pavement, the clicking of bicycle gears, a wooden staircase in a house that might have been childhood or might have been a place visited once and then borrowed by memory. The objects began to feel less like pieces in a puzzle and more like questions. The feather made a bridge that curved upward. The stone made one that curved down. The paper boat created a path that was narrow but long. The seed created a short, solid platform wherever another bridge ended, as though it believed in continuation. "Maybe it isn't about pairs," Mara said eventually. "Maybe it's about sequences." So we tried taking objects in order. Feather, boat, seed. The bridge lifted, extended, and made a small landing. Key, stone, feather. A different bridge appeared, but unstable, fading at the edges. When Mara picked up a seed after the stone, the fading stopped. It took a long time, and the long time was not unpleasant. There is a way of solving something slowly that becomes almost meditative. One stops needing the answer immediately. The room, the mist, the small gleam of objects in glass, the occasional sound of Mara laughing softly when the ship refused our more elaborate theories. All of it became the experience itself. Eventually we found the sequence. Feather for lift. Paper boat for crossing. Seed for continuation. Stone for weight. Key for arrival. When the last object was lifted from its sphere, the bridge extended through the mist all the way to the far door. It was not grand. It did not blaze with triumph. It simply formed, quietly and completely, as though it had always wanted to. Mara looked at me. "Shall we?" We crossed together. At the door, the five objects rose from our hands, drifted into small recesses around the frame, and became light. The hatch opened into a chamber filled with warm gold. Not gold as in metal, but gold as in late afternoon sun through curtains. Several people were already there. Some sat on benches along the walls. Some studied panels of shifting symbols. One person lay flat on their back beneath a large transparent table, staring upward through it at a constellation of colored points. The chamber was wide and circular, with multiple doors leading away from it. In the center stood a tall column of water, impossibly held in place without glass. Tiny silver fish moved within it, although whether they were alive or mechanical or symbolic seemed beside the point. A man with dark curly hair looked up from one of the panels and waved. "New arrivals from the mist?" "Yes," Mara said. "Good room," he said. "Takes a while, but it teaches you how the ship likes to think." "What is this place?" I asked. He considered. "A crossing room, a waiting room, a hub maybe. People call it different things. Antamas." There were six others there, each with a name found in clothing or on a cup, or in one case written faintly on the palm of a hand and then gone by the time anyone else looked. No one seemed frightened. Or if they were, the fear had become background, like the hum in the walls. Tomas explained as best he could that the ship was full of puzzle rooms. Some could be solved alone, some required several people, some seemed competitive at first, but usually turned out to be cooperative in a sideways fashion. A door might open for the first person to reach it, but the route taken by that person would illuminate another route for someone else. A race might reveal that there was no finish line, only a pattern visible from different speeds. "Where is the ship going?" I asked. A woman named Iona, who had been adjusting symbols on the wall, answered without turning. "Perhaps the ship is not the thing going." This was the kind of sentence that would have annoyed me in a different mood. In the warm chamber with silver fish moving up and down the column of water, it seemed worth leaving alone for a while. Mara chose to rest on one of the benches. I sat beside her. No one hurried us onward. That may have been the most curious thing. A ship filled with puzzles, yet without urgency. Doors waited. Rooms waited. People drifted in and out, sometimes returning to report what they had found. One room contained a forest of metal reeds that sang when touched, and the path through could only be found by making a cord no one person could reach alone. Another was a library, where all the books were blank until placed next to other books, at which point sentences appeared in the margins between them. Another was called the lantern room, where each person carried a light that showed only what someone else needed to see. I listened to these descriptions and watched the silver fish. After a while, Tomas asked whether I wanted to try the atrium of angles. His tone was mild, as though suggesting a walk after supper. Mara was still resting, eyes closed, but not asleep. She made a small motion with her hand that meant, "Go on," or perhaps I interpreted it that way. The atrium of angles was through a door marked with seven dots. Inside, the space seemed to fold. It was not disorienting, exactly, but it made the eye work differently. Stairways met walls at impossible inclines. Windows looked into other parts of the same room from above and below. Lines of light ran across surfaces and changed direction when watched directly, like shy insects. Three other people entered with us: Iona, a quiet man named Pell, and someone called Sarah who had a habit of humming under her breath while thinking. In the center of the atrium was a low table with a set of hinged rods. Above it floated an incomplete shape made of light. When one of us moved a rod on the table, part of the floating shape shifted, but it shifted not in the direction expected. A rod moved left, might tilt a luminous plane overhead. A hinge bent downward might rotate a distant stair. Tomas grinned, though gently. This one is easier if you stop assuming the room is facing the same way you are. That seemed like good advice for more than the room. We each stood on a different side of the table. From my side, the floating shape looked like a broken cube. From Sarah's, it looked like a star. From Iona's, it looked like a staircase folded into itself. Pell, after a long silence, said it looked like a chair. "A chair?" Tomas asked. "From here," Pell said, and indeed, when I walked around to his position, the lines aligned into something chair-like, though only briefly. Then they slipped apart again. The task was to make the shape complete from all sides at once. At first, we each tried to correct it from our own perspective, which only spoiled it for the others. My clean cube turned Sarah's star into a tangle. Iona's elegant staircase made Pell's chair lose a leg. We laughed quietly at this, because the room made disagreement visible without making it personal. Slowly we began to describe not what we wanted, but what we saw. "If that blue line comes toward me," Sarah said, "it meets the upper point." "When it does," Iona said, "the lower plane flattens here." "It makes the chair worse," Pell said. "Can the chair tolerate being less chair-like?" Tomas asked. Pell thought about it. "If it becomes more like a bench, the star became a lantern. The cube became a room. The staircase became a bridge. None of us got exactly the shape we first thought we were making. The finished form, when it finally settled, was difficult to name. It was open and balanced and somehow hospitable. It looked different from every side, yet complete from each." A tone sounded. A wall slid away, revealing not a new chamber, but a balcony. We stepped out. Beyond the balcony was space. The mist I had seen through the cabin window was below us now, or around us, or perhaps passing through some field the ship held at a respectful distance. Stars shone in layers. Some were sharp and white. Others glowed faintly behind veils of blue vapor. Far off, a nebula spread like milk poured into dark tea. No one spoke for a while. The ship itself extended beyond the balcony in both directions, enormous and graceful. Its outer hull was not smooth, as I had imagined, but terraced with gardens under domes, antennae like silver branches, slow-turning rings, and warm-lit windows. It looked less like a machine than a city that had learned to travel without disturbing its inhabitants. Below the balcony, along a curved section of hull, I saw figures moving in a glass corridor. Some walked alone, some in pairs. One person paused and raised a hand toward us. Though they could not possibly have known who we were, we waved back anyway. It occurred to me then that the puzzles might not be barriers, or not only barriers. They were a way of making the ship know us, and making us know one another. A door that opens too easily teaches nothing about the hand that opens it. A room that requires patience leaves patience behind in the walls. I thought of the black square beside the bed. Welcome back. Perhaps I had been here before. Perhaps everyone had. Perhaps waking was part of the ship's rhythm like breathing. You entered, forgot, remembered through doing. Or perhaps the ship gathered people from sleep, from memory, from those quiet interior places where unsolved things wait without bitterness. After a time, the others went back inside. I remained on the balcony. The stars did not move much, but the mist did. It curled and thinned, revealing glimpses of distant structures suspended in it. Another vessel, perhaps, or an island of lights, or a cluster of puzzle rooms not yet attached to anything. I was not sure. The uncertainty was pleasant. It left room. Mara found me there later. "I wondered where you'd gone," she said. "Just here." She leaned on the railing beside me. "There's a room with rain in it," she said. "I thought you might like it." "Rain? Inside glass or outside glass or both? People are trying to tune droplets on different panes to match a pattern in the floor." "That sounds impossible." "Not impossible. Just slow." We stood quietly. "Do you think there's an end?" I asked. to the ship, to the puzzles. Mara considered. She seemed to take every question as if it deserved to be set down carefully before being answered. Maybe an ending is one kind of room, but not necessarily the next one. This too seemed worth leaving alone. We returned through the atrium of angles, where the floating shape still hovered, complete and unnamed. In the warm hub chamber, new people had arrived. One was explaining with the calm intensity of fresh discovery that a hallway near the lower ring changed length, depending on whether you walked while remembering a song or a place. Someone else was trying to map the doors, though the map had already developed 3 extra corners and a small drawing of a fish. Mara led me to the rain room. It was smaller than I expected. A quiet chamber with dark blue walls and a floor of pale stone. Suspended throughout were clear panes at different angles, and water ran over them in fine streams. Each pane made a different sound, tapping, whispering, soft drumming, the delicate hiss of rain on leaves. Beneath the floor, lines of light pulsed in a slow sequence. Several people sat or stood among the panes, adjusting their angles by hand. No one spoke above a murmur. The room smelled faintly of wet earth, though there was no earth in sight. Mara and I watched the lights for a while. The pattern repeated but with small variations, like a melody half remembered. We each chose a pane and tilted it slightly. The sound changed. Somewhere across the room, someone adjusted another pane in response. The puzzle was not solved while I was there, or perhaps it was being solved continuously by everyone listening. After some time, I sat on the floor with my back against the wall. The rain sounds overlapped and separated. The lights moved beneath the stone. Mara stood nearby, her hand resting on a pane that whispered under the water. I felt no great need to know the final room. This surprised me. For years, perhaps, the dream had begun with waking and wandering and solving, always moving toward some conclusion that never quite arrived. But sitting there in the ship's rain, I wondered whether the lack of an ending had been a flaw, only because I had expected the dream to behave like a story told from the outside. From within, it felt different. The ship did not withhold its answer. It offered rooms. There might be a central chamber somewhere, with a window looking onto the destination. There might be a last puzzle that gathered all the earlier ones. Motion, mist, objects, angles, rain, memory, other people's voices. There might be a door that opened not outward, but inward, into the place one had been trying to return to all along. Or there might simply be another corridor, a soft one, lit along the floor, a door marked with a symbol I did not yet understand, a cup of water waiting in a quiet cabin. At length, the rain room dimmed, not into darkness, but into evening. The panes continued to sing. People drifted out in twos and threes. Mara sat beside me. Sleepy? She asked. A little. There are resting rooms near here. We walked without hurry. The corridor beyond the rain room curved gently downward. On the walls, the silver thread lines flowed beside us, occasionally brightening as we passed. I wondered whether they were maps of where we had been, or where we might go, or whether the ship saw no strong difference between those. Mara stopped at a door marked with a small crescent. "These rooms are kind," she said. The door opened into a cabin, much like the one in which I had awakened, though the window was larger. Outside it, the mist moved in long, slow bands. A bed waited, narrow and soft. On the desk sat another black square, unlit. Mara stood in the doorway. "I'll be nearby," she said, "or somewhere." "Thank you," she smiled. "We'll probably find another impossible room tomorrow." The door closed softly after her. I sat on the edge of the bed and removed my shoes. The hum of the ship was present here too, a low steady note under everything. I touched the black square. It lit. For a moment, it showed no words. Only the 3 blue circles from the first door. They drifted apart, curved inward, and met at the center together. Then a line appeared. "Rest is also a passage." I lay down. Through the window, the mist thinned, and I saw stars. Not many, just enough. One bright, one dim, a cluster like spilled salt. The ship moved, or the stars moved, or I moved within the gentle machinery of sleep. Somewhere beyond the wall, water ran over glass. Somewhere, perhaps, a group of people leaned over a table, trying to make one shape whole from many sides. Somewhere a bridge waited inside a feather, a seed, a stone. I thought again of endings. Some dreams end by waking. Some end by being forgotten. But others do not end so much as step aside, letting morning pass through, waiting with patient rooms until the next time the mind grows quiet enough to find the door. The bed remembered me. The ship hummed, and beyond the window, in the blue-white mist, a faint light appeared, not distant and not near, like a doorway slowly deciding to become visible.